May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. John Gigas on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Watson. The issue in this appeal is whether the Madison Police Department unlawfully seized Mr. Watson without reasonable suspicion of a violent crime. Mr. Watson's Fourth Amendment right to unreasonable seizure was violated because of a high-risk stop against the passenger, Mr. Watson, in a car being pulled over for a minor traffic offense. In this case, an unlit license plate.
You say high-risk stop?
High-risk stop, yes, Your Honor. A felony stop, that was the term that was used in the police reports in which the police surround the car, blockade it, and with guns drawn, proceed to remove the occupants under the threat and display of force, handcuff, and separate them in separate cars.
So what do you think the police should have done?
Your Honor, I think that the police should have done a couple of different things. First was to have corroborated more information, particularly the caller's identity, for the anonymous tip that they were relying on.
How do they do that? What if a caller doesn't want to give his identity?
Well, Your Honor, in this instance, as the government pointed out, the police believe that the caller had provided enough information that they possibly could have identified his identity. Two facts on that. One was that the caller claimed to have been personally familiar with Lieutenant Strong in the Madison Police Department, and then two, he had also claimed that he had recently spoke with Chief Noble Ray at, I believe, a picnic in Madison. And despite having both of those facts at their disposal, the Madison Police Department, in particular Officer Mulray, failed to follow up on those leads. When Officer Mulray first got off the phone with the caller, he contacted Detective Denise Armstrong, and Detective Armstrong advised Officer Mulray that it was important to obtain the caller's identity. When Officer Mulray recontacted the caller and tried to obtain further information about the caller's identity, the caller became angry, said that he shouldn't have answered the call in the first place,
right,
became
so
clearly
what should
agitated.
The police have done at that point?
In that instance, Your Honor, the police should have taken the information they did have to further corroborate with Lieutenant Strong and Chief Ray the information they did have, because at this point, the caller had clearly been very agitated, had been very upset, and I suggested that perhaps very unpredictable. In fact, Your Honor, in Officer Mulray's report, he actually specifically noted, although difficult to put into words, he believed that the caller was being truthful. However, difficult to put into words, I respectfully suggest, is very close to a hunch, which this circuit has noted, for instance, United States versus Baskin, 401 F3rd 788, that a hunch standing alone is not sufficient grounds for reasonable
suspicion.
But it
was way more than that, because once they calmed the caller down, he gave very specific information about what he had seen, how he saw the two police officers arrest an individual at 6:30, and then Mulroy confirmed this information with the dispatcher, right, and established the timeline. He gave details in terms of who was in the car, driven by a white woman and a black male passenger. So more information came from this caller, and then they observed these things. At least the individuals, when they were stopped, were just who he described. I mean, we have more than just a tip with no corroboration, don't we?
Well, that's correct, Judge Williams, but the corroboration that did occur in this instance was largely harmless facts, such as the description of the car, the having dents.
Harmless facts? I don't understand.
Well, Your Honor,
can harmless facts corroborate?
I'm sorry?
Can't harmless facts corroborate?
They can, Your Honor, but under Florida versus JL, for instance, Supreme Court 529 U.S. 266, an anonymous tip has to provide some predictive information about future legal activity. It must be more than the ability to identify a determinate person, which in this instance was all the tip provided, that they were all able to identify generally a particular person.
Predictive criminal conduct? What are you talking about?
They need to have more than just information that allows them to identify a particular person, Your Honor.
What more do you need?
In this instance, Your Honor, I think that they needed to have more credibility that the caller was someone who had in the past been a reliable informant, as he claimed. The police did have that ability within their possession, however.
They can't respond to a first tip? The person has to have a record of tips?
No, Your Honor, but in this instance, given the agitated state of the caller, the fact that Officer Mulray himself acknowledged that, you know, his reasons for believing and trusting the caller were, quote, difficult to put into words, end quote, that on that basis they should have, Officer Mulray in particular, should have followed up with Lieutenant Strong or Chief Ray.
What would he have found out if he'd done that?
We don't know, Your Honor.
You know, Mr. Dekus, I was thinking of a question for Ms. Rumblow because the anonymous caller's tip included quite a bit of detail. Mm-hmm. In fact, it made me wonder whether there was too much detail. I mean, when a tipster has information about a green cup in the front cup holder and a black case on the back seat, and conversations about where the driver intended to drive next, I have to wonder whether the anonymous caller was sort of hysterical because the anonymous caller was actually in the car and part of the illegal activity. I mean, I really have been wondering about that.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, I think two points. First, the caller's ability to identify a specific person was limited to those facts of the car. And second, given, like you said, the excited, upset nature of the caller, his credibility was important to determine in that sense because none of the information that the caller did provide went beyond identifying a particular suspect. And in fact, as I believe it was Officer Harris's report noted, Mr. Watson was not identified until after the stop was executed.
But I thought when he called in and they had this hour-long conversation with the tipster, he said he was in his early 30s. He was 5'7 to 5'8. He had a hefty bill. He had chin hair. He was wearing jeans, a dark shirt with thin stripes, a dark hat with an emblem. And the same thing with the woman. She's in her early 30s, 5'7, hefty bill, mullet hairstyle, and wearing cut-off jeans. So, you know, I mean, I don't know how more detailed you could get in terms of a description of them.
Well, Judge Williams,
and dents in the car.
Well, Judge Williams, Mr. Watson's position is that under Florida versus JL, the ability to identify a particular person by itself is not enough, that there needs to be something beyond that going to illegal activity or predictive information about not easily known movements, future movements of the suspect. With respect to the green cup that Judge Rovner pulled up, for example.
I understand that. Why isn't it a detailed description thing that Judge Williams reviewed? Why doesn't that help to corroborate the person's statement, unless you think he made it all up?
Well, no, Your Honor. I think, one, the police didn't have sufficient information about the caller's credibility to know or to trust whether the caller was making it up.
Do you know what that means? It means you can never, ever be the first anonymous caller. Mm-hmm. There can never be an anonymous caller because there has to, you know, an anonymous caller has to start his career or her career somewhere.
Well, I respectfully disagree with your that point, Judge Rovner, on the basis that in this instance, Officer Mulray himself concluded in his police report that it was difficult to articulate why exactly he trusted this caller. So in spite of that information, and I would suggest it in large part because the caller was so agitated, was so defensive when Officer Mulray attempted to obtain the caller's identity after being instructed to do so by Detective Armstrong, that Officer Mulray's own report itself confirms that Officer Mulray had some doubts of his own. And that nonetheless proceeded on what, which is my term, a hunch.
But then didn't the guy, when he was asked about his identity, I mean, he gave a reason why he didn't want to give his identity, because he'd been burned in the past. That he was assaulted after a police officer promised to keep his name out from a report, but his name ended up in the report.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I believe that Officer Mulray's promise to keep the informant's name out of the report was reasonable. However, Officer Mulray still had within his ability to contact both Lieutenant Strong and Chief Ray and say, you know, is this guy somebody you've dealt with in the past? Is he reliable? Has he been a reliable informant? And that would have been enough to both assuage the caller's concern about having his identity disclosed, as well as Officer Mulray's stated difficulty in articulating why he felt the informant was reliable.
Or else he would think he would get his nose broken a second time because this is all being published.
Judge Robner, I think that Officer Mulray could in fact have confirmed that the caller was reliable without obtaining his actual name and or putting it in his police report. Those were steps that Officer Mulray didn't take, despite the fact that Detective Armstrong advised him to obtain the caller's identity just so his credibility could be checked, and that also because of Officer Mulray's
own. But you're assuming that the police officer that you worked for in the past only had one informant. You know what I mean? That Wayne Strong, I mean, there could have been many informants. I'm just saying if the thing played out as you thought, that wouldn't necessarily corroborate it either, because Strong could have had plenty of informants. And when this guy didn't identify himself on the line, he could have other informants that were caught in the same kind of situation. And I'm just saying it doesn't necessarily mean that the call would have borne fruit. That's
possible.
Reliability.
That's possible, Judge Williams, but I believe that the government itself has argued that the caller was not really anonymous because of the ability for Officer Mulray to contact Lieutenant Strong or Chief Ray, which obviously in this instance it's Mr. Watson's position, that those were reasonable and frankly easy steps that Officer Mulray could have taken to eliminate the doubt expressed in Officer Mulray's own report.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gikas.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rita Rumbelow on behalf of the United States. What the appellant's argument completely overlooks is that the anonymous caller is kind of irrelevant in this case. There was probable cause to stop the car driven by Cheryl Messino. That is undisputed. Her rear license plate was not illuminated, so there was absolutely nothing wrong with the police stopping her car. Shortly thereafter, she provided consent to search the car. So really, there's absolutely no connection to how the police stopped the car to their discovery of the evidence. So Mr. Watson's argument really misses the mark. But we just argued alternatively that if, for sake of argument only, there hadn't been probable cause to stop her car for the traffic violation, clearly there was reasonable suspicion provided by this anonymous caller, and I think the court recognizes that. And how this anonymous caller knew what he knew and saw the great details, because he sat there and watched Mr. Watson sell a gun out of the trunk of his car in the Allied Drive neighborhood in Madison earlier that day. So the caller was close enough to see Mr. Watson sell the gun, remove a clip from the gun, saw that he still had additional firearms in the car, and that's how the caller was so close to see the dents, the green cup holder, to see their physical description, and heard them say that they were going to travel then to the Tucson apartment complex later in the afternoon or the evening.
Am I the only one wondering whether the anonymous caller was actually in the car and part of the illegal activity?
It doesn't matter, Your Honor, not at all. I mean, the caller said that he was sitting in a car with his girlfriend that afternoon right next to the Messino vehicle. The caller said he was sitting in the Allied Drive parking lot. Messino's car pulled in with Watson. I mean, he didn't know their names, of course. And he was close enough to watch this gun transaction.
And to see a dent in a green cup in the front.
Yes.
And to hear where the driver intended to drive next.
Correct. That's what the caller said, but he did provide enough detail. But again, it really just doesn't matter because of the traffic violation and Cheryl Messino's consent to search the car. So if the court doesn't have any further questions, I ask that you affirm the judgment and conviction of the district court. Thank you,
Ms. Rumbelow. So, Mr. Gikas, your time expired. You can have another minute if you'd like.
Very brief, Your Honor. Mr. Watson's point is that probable cause for an unlit license plate is not grounds for a high-risk stop with an overwhelming display of police force. The court is recognized.
So what is the violation? I don't understand.
Mr. Watson was subject to an unreasonable seizure under the Fourth Amendment.
You mean unreasonable because Because what? He wasn't beaten up or anything.
Because the police did not have reasonable suspicion of a violent crime. And as this court has recognized in Askew 403 F3rd 496 and Tillman 19 F3rd 1221, there needs to be some reasonable basis for the police to use an overwhelming display of force. And I realize that the police have a great deal of discretion in that area. But Mr. Watson's position is that in this case, in the narrow grounds of this case, the police had no basis for that elevated response. That all that they had, the probable cause argument that the government puts forth, misses the mark in the sense that it was
I don't think that's right. If they have the right to arrest someone, it seems to me they have the right to, you know, take whatever measures they think is necessary for their precaution.
Well, Your Honor, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
As the court has noted in both Askew and Tillman, there needs to be some reasonable basis.
That doesn't make any sense. I mean, obviously there's a strong interest in not being arrested, but if you're going to be lawfully arrested, and of course strong interest not being beaten up, but I don't think there's any particular interest in how many police officers arrest you.
It's not so many how many, Your Honor. It is the means of guns drawn. It's the overwhelming display of force that it's constitutionally
pointing the guns at Watson?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may pick up on the point that Judge Rovner made in the first argument, in this instance there were six of the most powerful people in the world with their guns drawn on Mr. Watson and Ms. Messino. Based on what was probable cause.
They're pointing their guns at them?
Yes, Your Honor. For a nonviolent traffic offense.
So what does this have to do with the Fourth Amendment?
That it was an unreasonable seizure, Your Honor. That it was an excessive execution of police force against Mr. Watson.
And I understand, you know, you can't seize a person without probable cause or something like that, but you can't shoot them, obviously, or hit them. But the police feel endangered. I don't think they have to have reasonable suspicion or probable cause just to feel in danger.
Well, Your Honor, in this instance, I don't believe that the police did have a reasonable basis to feel that their personal safety was...
a gun dealer, right?
Well, and that's where the reasonable suspicion of the anonymous tipster is so important.
If you're dealing with a gun dealer, you want to be very careful.
Well, and that's exactly why the issue of reasonable suspicion based on the anonymous tip is so important, Your Honor. It does matter.
I don't agree with you. I don't agree with you. The important thing is they have the right to arrest this person. How they do it, where they point a gun at someone, draw a gun, one policeman, 10 policemen, that seems to me to be such a small detail that... And certainly wouldn't have anything to do with a person's conviction, right? I mean, maybe he'd have some constitutional tort suit about being threatened with a gun, but what would that have to do with the lawfulness of the arrest?
Well, Your Honor, one would be that Mr. Watson was subject to an unreasonable seizure and put in a position of threat to his safety, because every time the police...
Well, that's an argument for some kind of constitutional tort suit. It doesn't have anything to do with the seizure of the evidence.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that had the police used less violent or less intrusive means in executing their stop, that not only the facts of this
but
case...
It's just the wrong remedy. You just have the wrong remedy. This is a proper arrest, proper seizure of evidence, nothing wrong there. But you say, you know, excessive force or what have you. Well, fine, then you can have some kind of remedy for excessive force, but you don't exclude the evidence because which was properly seized just because there was some incidental violation of a person's rights. That's a misuse of the exclusionary rule.
And, Your Honor, Mr. Watson's position is that an excessive display of police force where there's no threat to officer safety...
Why should it invalidate a conviction when they had every right to arrest him and to seize the evidence?
Because Your Honor...
What if they stepped on his foot by accident? Well, what would you say about that?
Your Honor, respectfully, Mr. Watson submits that the difference between stepping on somebody's foot versus having six service weapons trained on your person at a given moment are two extreme situations, and that in the instance...
But the remedy is wrong, because they're wrong the wrong, what you think is their wrongful act, their use of excessive force, it doesn't have any connection to their right to seize the evidence.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Watson's position is that it,
there's
that
no
it
invasion of the of property rights in the guns or privacy or being able to conceal your guns from the police or anything of that sort. Nothing connected with the historical purposes of the Fourth Amendment. It's some extraneous, you know, they say it could be tortious activities if they've beaten them up or something. It doesn't have anything to do with their right to seize the evidence.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Watson's position is that his rights were violated the moment that the stop was executed in the manner it was, and that what followed after that is irrelevant.
Well, his remedy is a civil suit for damages. But, of course, good luck.
I appreciate
it. Okay, thank you for your accepting the appointment and your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. And we